Hey, welcome to Trapital. I'm your host, Dan Runcie. This is your place to gain insights on the business that shapes music, media, and culture. We dive deep into the companies and moguls who start the trends that shape the rest of the business world. The music business is full of powerful narratives that can shape the perception of the entire industry. We hear the statements all the time. This is the worst time ever for a new artist that's trying to break through. And things are so much better in the CD era. Well, it's not that those statements are necessarily untrue or true, but there's a lot more nuance and context and plenty of evidence that may prove the opposite is actually true. And that's going to be the focus for today's episode. We're joined by BeatBread's Peter Sinclair. He's the co-founder and CEO of the company. And if you follow Peter on LinkedIn, you know he is not shy about keeping it real about his opinions on different topics. So we talk about that. And we also talk about some of the things that BeatBread has seen that prove some of these things to be true or untrue one way or another. This is a really fun conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. So let's dive in. All right. Today we have a fun episode. We have BeatBread's Peter Sinclair with us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Dan. It's great to be here. I really appreciate it.
One of the reasons I wanted to have you on is because one of the things that I often hear back and forth from people is whether or not it's a good time or a bad time to be a rising artist today. And there's a lot of nuance, but there's also some common narratives that probably need some debunking. So let's start there.
Yeah, my view, and let me first say, I've never been a recording artist myself, and it has always been insanely hard to be an artist. I want to be clear about that. That said, it is unequivocally the best time in the history of the music industry to be a recording artist. It's less expensive. There aren't as many gatekeepers that stand between an artist and their fans. And frankly, there are 10 times more artists who can make a meaningful living on the recorded music than there were even a decade ago. And that's only growing. So it is the best time ever.
And I have some stats for you on this because Spotify puts out their Loud and Clear report every year. And one of the stats that stuck out was there are 20,000 total acts whose catalogs, music, recording, and publishing have generated over $50,000. And that's just on Spotify. So their math is if you take our number, we account for 20 to 25% of revenue, that's $200,000. I can't think of a time in the CD era or in the past where there were that many people making this much money from music.
There's no question about it. So all the research and triangulation we've done tells us that until streaming took off, fairly constantly for several decades, about 5,000 artists globally made more than $50,000 on the recorded music and in an inflation-controlled way. That exploded around 2015 as Spotify really took off, and obviously other streaming services as well. What's gone on in the music industry has happened faster, but there are parallels to it in video or television. I'm old enough now. On the spectrum, I'm an older founder than your average. When I grew up, there were four stations. There was PBS, ABC, CBS, and ABC. That was it. Some of my friends' parents paid for cable, but that was a luxury good. And now most homes in America literally have thousands of channels. So there are all these micro fandoms, each of which are not only economically viable, but economically thriving. But what I watch on television may be different than you. I may see someone on the street and be starstruck, and you have no idea who it is. It went from a small number of big stars to lots of people can make thousands, tens of thousands. More than 1,000 people made more than $1 million on Spotify. Once again, only about 20, 30, 40% of the industry last year. I believe 1,000 people who made more than $1 million on Spotify didn't have a top 50 song all year. There's this sort of fragmentation of fandom. It's really bad in politics. We're all in our own little bubble. But in music, I think it's great. It's great culturally. Outside the United States, there are all these fandoms that are exploding and are viable that never got a voice before. It's a very exciting time.
But why is that not the narrative? Why is the narrative flipped? You're more likely to hear someone that says, oh, when I was managing this indie act in 1994, we could have sold 20,000 copies. We sold 20,000 copies. We get $5 from every copy. We could have got 100,000. Everyone eats. Why is that the narrative?
Part of what's going on is Spotify is a victim of its own success. It has made it so much more possible for more people to get their music out so cheaply and to so many fans that people who never would have had a shot get to take a swing. And most of those people fail. And it's really hard to be an artist. I think part of it is lazy journalism, frankly. It's very easy to pick on the big bad corporate company, interview someone who's only making $8 a year on Spotify and say that they're not paying enough. I also say Spotify should pay more, right? There should be much more effort to get more dollars per listener. So it's not that Spotify can't do better, but the difference between what is available to artists now and what was available 10 years ago, it's not even night and day. It's remarkable.
Especially when you think about things globally, we're no longer dealing with the same gatekeepers. And the thing that I often think back to is, was it easier for an artist in the 80s or 90s to break out and make it on MTV? Or was it easier now to break out on Spotify? And I lean towards the latter.
Yes, for sure. There's no question about it, right? There are only so many channels on the television. There are only so many hours in the day to get on MTV. There are only so many channels on the radio dial. In a world of streaming, there are thousands and thousands of fandoms that one can access. So it's much easier to break through, and it's much easier to nurture a viable fan base and make a real living on it.
This conversation is also taking a step back and looking at how artists are making money even outside of recorded music and publishing, because they're making so much more money from touring now. They're making so much more money from merchandise and all of the other various income streams that artists participate in.
That's right. And Spotify, in addition to the direct income, and Apple and YouTube and Amazon, is also a great lead gen to develop that fan base and make that money on the road, make that money from merch, all those other things. Some people are more successful than others, but absolutely, if you have a fan base of a few thousand, I'm not sure I believe in the 1,000 fans only model. I think that's a little light, but the basic idea is right. If you have a relatively small number of passionate fans, you can really make quite a living in a sustained way if you get it right.
Because we're talking about artists that are hitting these benchmarks, but I'm sure you and I both know artists that may not be hitting those benchmarks that are still doing it. One of the rule of thumbs I saw that Spotify, one of their directors had shared an interview. They said, if you look at an artist that has between 4 to 5 million monthly listeners, you could use that as a proxy to say that is an artist whose catalog is generating $1 million on Spotify alone. But I know artists that have far fewer than that, that are making millions. And it's when you combine all of these different revenue streams.
That's right. It's different revenue streams. It's also mixed. So when we see deals all the time, we're doing more than a deal a day. Some artists are 80% Spotify. Other artists are 30% Spotify. And once again, lest anyone thinks I'm in the tank for Spotify, Apple and Amazon pay a whole lot more per stream than Spotify does. And so we see artists who are making a whole bunch more per fan on Spotify when they have that other mix as well. And would love to see the payout rates on those on Spotify sort of start to approach those other streaming services. Yeah, but there's definitely opportunity. We've done deals with artists making more than $1 million a year who are well below that threshold. There's no question about it.
And then with those other services, looking at Apple and Amazon, do you think it's that those services do pay more, or is it that those subscribers aren't free and the subscribers just stream music less?
Yes and yes. Is it A or B? Yes. So I think engagement on Spotify is absolutely higher. There's no question about it. There are fewer free streamers. I think, however, that there's probably a little less pressure in those organizations to eke every last dollar out of the business. You know, Spotify, it's harder to be a standalone streaming service than if you're bolted onto Amazon Prime or all the whole Apple ecosystem. My sense is it's a combination of all those things. I'm sure that the folks who negotiate those deals at Merlin or Universal or Warner know the absolute answer to that question. I don't. I think it's a combination of all of them.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. Speaking of platforms that have high engagement, we should also talk about YouTube in this same way, because another myth that we often talk about is Spotify being painted as the villain for a lot of the reasons we've discussed. People have issues with payouts. People have issues with their perception of how many artists are making a living, but artists get even less money on YouTube.
Yeah, I get it and I don't get it, but it is strange that YouTube seems to get a free pass and pays so much less per fan and per stream. One of the ways that Spotify could pay artists more is by raising prices. But if you're thinking yourselves into the Spotify boardroom, if they're raising prices, the danger is that more consumers opt out for free services like YouTube, right? So YouTube arguably is part of the reason that Spotify doesn't pay more, because it puts that pressure on the subscription prices. And I don't know why YouTube never became the villain that Spotify did. Maybe it's because Spotify is a music-only service, so people just think about YouTube more broadly. I think Spotify is a little bit of a victim of its own very high aspirations. What the original idea was, what, 1 million artists can make a meaningful living on their art. Spotify is nowhere near that number. It's growing, but still not even a tenth of that. And yeah, I'm not sure why YouTube gets a free pass. I wish that people would think a little more broadly when they're thinking about it. Not to defend Spotify, but frankly to get artist payouts up. Right? The pressure should be on at YouTube.
YouTube has probably had its own degree of this that's looked a little bit different over the years. Of course, Warner had pulled its music off of YouTube for 9 months back in the late 2000s. And before the past few years when Leo Cohen's been there, there's definitely been some tensions and people have had issues. But I do think that Spotify has been, in many ways, the company that's been out in front because, like you said, this is seen as the standalone music streaming company, and this is the core service. And even though they're adding other things, it's all an add-on versus YouTube can sit in two worlds where, one, there's all these other things on the platform, but two, it can also blur the lines a bit because it's also a creation platform. You can upload directly there as opposed to Spotify. And we've clearly seen how the creation platforms can have a bit more leeway with TikTok and Universal, but I think that's part of it too.
Yeah, I think that's right. So yeah, I don't know all the answers. It would be great to see artists get paid more across the board. And I think part of that is finding more than one way to criticize the industry and put pressure on it. And so I think Spotify can absolutely do better, but maybe the pressure should also be elsewhere as well.
On this note too, there has been a lot of focus recently about superfans. Goldman Sachs had put out that Music in the Air report last year, and one of the big things that they had said was they assume that you can get 20% of the people that currently subscribe to streaming services to pay some type of premium, because that 20% of listeners, they are considered super fans of at least one artist, and they're willing to pay twice as much to support that artist in some type of way. I had ran a poll on either LinkedIn or Twitter that looked at this, and it asked this exact question. And 20% of the people said yes, which was interesting.
No, I said no. $2 a month just for a week early to listen to a song? No, I wouldn't. Now, the super fan opportunity is huge. I think it needs to be better. It's also really hard. People have tried this for a while. I think it's not just getting music earlier. It needs to be a richer kind of content. So I'm actually very excited about the move to push video and music together, not just UGC, but real storytelling. One of the criticisms Ray Daniels makes a lot is we're in an era that the song is the star, not the person, right? And that becomes that much more dangerous with the AI and all these other things. I think if there's content that really imports meaning and story, right? You think about why Taylor Swift's been so successful, right? There's a real backstory and a narrative to the music. Same thing with Beyonce's latest album, right? All of her albums, right? But in particular, I think the last, if you really want to engage super fans, there needs to be a story behind that. And I think video's part of it. I don't know all the ins and outs of it. I think Spotify could probably share more fan data with its artists. There's some real value there. But it's a hard problem because Spotify wants to make more money per user. They need to pay more to artists. And the way to do that is superfan. I don't think it's for lack of trying. I don't have the perfect answer, but there's a huge opportunity there. And the secret sauce is something around richer content, not just early content.
Video is something that Spotify has tried in different ways, and we've seen some of it worked, some of it they pulled back over time. Most of these DSPs have some sort of TikTok short form video style feed. If the numbers work out, even if 80%, 4 out of every 5 people say no, then they have the 1/5 that would say yes. I still think that's a high number, because you're banking on someone having that as a perpetual part of their subscription and not just something where, okay, if I am a Tyler, the Creator fan, then I want to hear his album early. And is that the best place to do it? So I think that's one part of the challenge. And I think the other thing too is that the super fan discussion has often been rooted as a recorded music problem. But if we take a step back, does the super fan narrative solve itself where super fans buy tickets to the concerts and festivals, super fans buy merchandise, and you look at the distribution of the people that stream an album versus buy each of these things, Is that how the system forces itself out?
Yeah, I think it does. I'm not going to shed a tear for Beyonce or Taylor or these superstars who are making all on their way to become billionaires. But if you think about this other class of artists, their fan bases are spread out in most cases. Some are concentrated in geographies, but around the country, it's more psychographic segments. And there are limits to what touring can do if you only have 1,000 fans in every city, right? And so it would be great if technology could do something to replicate something as precious and meaningful and deep as the live experience. And it needs to be different. And you can't replicate live online, right? And I think that's the key to unlocking the super fan. And that is how artists are going to get paid more. And so if Spotify doesn't do it and someone else solves that super fan thing, that monetization in a digital world, Spotify doesn't deserve to be the leader anymore. The race is on. I'm not sure who's going to win. I haven't really seen anything that I'm like, oh, that's it yet. But I think it's coming.
So much of the conversation feels like it's stemmed around new releases, but what are these albums that have been released that have legs? Because there's clearly people that are coming back to the app to listen to that again and again. I look at SZA releasing SOS. That has been on the top 10 for a year and a half now. It's probably going to be 2 years. That's rare. And that matters more than first week numbers. How do you monetize that?
Yeah, I think once something has legs, there should be a way to build around it. There's a lot of exciting stuff about remixes and all the stuff with AI and fan engagement. I'm personally not as bullish on the fan making opportunity as a lot of people are. I think really quality content that's deep and meaningful probably isn't coming from UGC. Not to say that there's not some legs in that, but I just think there needs to be more content that sticks more with people, because in a world where there are more artists, where there is more content, there's more competition for one's attention, whether it's music or video or short form video from TikTok or whatever. One way is to be very negative on that, that it's all clutter and it's all crap. But the reality is quality is going to be at a premium in a world that's more and more crowded. And once again, I'll go back to my television analogy. Television is so much better than when I was growing up now. And frankly, the best video content on the television screen, I would argue, is better than what is up at the Oscars every year. And that's because it's so competitive. You need quality to come through. I don't think that music has come up with that secret sauce just yet,
because it's probably less about the individual artists themselves, where that's not to say that Billie Eilish isn't making an album that isn't just as good as whoever from the 90s, but more so how does this overall package look? Because I think with the video comparison, it's tough to compare a show like Succession to anything that came out 20-25 years ago.
There's just so much more content on television that's like that, and someone's got to get the media right in music to get that real meaningful bit through to help artists stick with their fan bases. We see artists all the time that have one huge song and they come to us and they're looking for us to fund their next project. And we look at a number of variables, but the odds that next song will be big are very low unless they have a very meaningful and committed fan base, right? We can see that is a prediction not only of the durability, to your point about SZA, of the song, but the more durable and passionate fans you have, the greater chances that you will grow and be able to sustain your career. And I think the platforms need to help artists develop that and not just reward plays on a single song.
Let's take a break for our Chartmetric stat of the week. Ariana Grande had the less than ideal timing of releasing an album right in the middle of Universal Music Group and TikTok's three-month dispute. Despite the timing, her TikTok followers still grew by around 900,000 in the period from February 27th to May 26th. Still growth, maybe not as much as there could have been, but shows that there was still traction and demand. Let's get back to the episode.
Yeah.
So at BeatBread, how do you all do that specifically? Because a lot of the work is more analytically driven. If you have this or this is the advance that you get. But so much of what you describe also feels intangible.
Yeah. So let me say this. I do not discount the golden ear and the qualitative assessment of an artist's potential. Someone like Clive Davis, I believe, really had a magic touch and a magic kind of taste. All I know is I don't have that, and no one who works for us does either. We try and distill those things down into actual metrics. So we don't just look at streams and history and mix of platform. We look at metrics that get at the durability and passion of fandom. So for example, an artist who has a million streams in a given unit of time from 100,000 people is not only going to have more durable streams over time than someone, say, a million streams from 500,000 people, right? It's better to have intense fandom that will predict durability, growth, all those other things. We look at engagement on social platforms. We look at engagement on YouTube, comments on YouTube, things like that. We look for press mentions. It's probably the closest thing to subjective, but we look at other people's subjective elements. And we've been pretty good at predicting the outcomes, not just of existing music, but also future releases too. Now, it's harder to predict new music than it is something that's been out for 6 months or a year or 5 years. But we've been remarkably accurate in how we've done it, not on any given track. But the analogy we always make is, if a weatherman tells you that there's a 70% chance of rain, and it rains, how do you know if he's any good? You don't, unless he tells you that 100 times. And if it rains 70 times, he's really good. And that's the kind of accuracy that we've been able to achieve in both our new music and our existing music predictions. We are in the process, to answer the other part of your question, of trying to use data to figure out who the people who are involved in a project that have that subjective ability, that if they are involved, that it actually objectively by the numbers increases the likelihood that something will succeed. That's a project where we've seen a couple of early indications. We do a lot of research and lots of analytics before we build them into our algorithms. That's something that will be more baked into our algorithm over the coming year, but we definitely see opportunities. If this producer who's a no-name is involved, actually, if you're in this genre, your chances of having a breakout hit are that much higher, right? All that stuff is not in the algo yet, but coming soon. Yeah.
So we should look out for a Metro Boomin multiplier.
That's right. There you go. There you go. I'm going to use that. Yeah. I like that.
It reminds me of another piece that you had put out about features and the impact of those. And I feel like there's some similarity there because you've all done the studies on that. And I think that has some interesting findings too.
It was a little counterintuitive to me, to be totally honest. Artists would come to us. They'd be looking for money. We'd say, your project is worth X. And we'd say, you got to be kidding me. I've got this feature on it. And so we started to look at it and we realized that was a fair point. Features can make individual songs do better. That is undeniable, right? If Drake or Kendrick, depending on where you net out on that one, wanted to do a song, that song would get a lot more listens than if I did it alone, right? What was interesting, however, that we found out, and this goes back to the importance of fandom, is the odds that my career, other than that song, for the song after that one will actually do better, are almost unimpacted. Now, that's not to say that artists, as they grow and they start to do those features, you don't see them go up and up. But there are other things that happen that would cause Drake or Kendrick or whomever to get on a feature that are happening anyway, and that person would be growing. We found that the impact on an artist's career of a superstar joining a track, we couldn't see any statistically significant impact at all, right? And so it's not to say that artists shouldn't do features, right? They make a great song, right? That and it's not to say that song isn't worth more. But other things probably explain artist growth after a big feature than the feature itself.
I remember right around the time that had came out, Meg Thee Stallion had released her second album and Future was a guest on it. And she had did some interview where she said she paid Future $250,000 for the feature. And I remember at the time being like, really? Really? Future's great. He's one of the most commercially successful streaming artists, but wow.
Once again, if I'm a lawyer and I'm negotiating that deal, if I believe that artist will have that direct impact on that song, and to your point, songs can have legs for years, that's what you pay for, right? You pay for the impact on the song. But the idea that, you know, Megan's already very successful trajectory is going to be that much better because of the feature, not so sure.
And this is where the nuance comes, because tying back into the earlier point, a producer could have a bit more influence, but a guest artist, maybe.
A producer different. Absolutely does. And the producer doesn't need to be famous. that in a particular genre, a producer can absolutely have an outsized weight on a project for an artist. There's no question about it.
We talked earlier about how it's arguably easier than ever, relatively speaking, for an artist to break through. It's still tough work. That doesn't mean it's easy. But on the other side, it's tougher to reach Taylor Swift, Beyonce, Adele, Drake levels. And I grouped those artists specifically because they were all artists that were on top of the world at that moment, right before streaming took off. Late 2000s, early 2010s, they're all doing their thing. So by the time streaming took off, they blow up. And then now, 10 years after things really start to take off for streaming, they're still the biggest artists in the world. And I don't think that's a coincidence.
In terms of just raw number of real fans, I think you're probably right. I think in terms of dollars, you don't have to be as big as Guns N' Roses or Queen was before streaming to make in a lifetime as much money as those bands will end up making. But I know it's not just about the money, right? Artists want fame and an impact on lives and all those things. Billie Eilish, I think, is an interesting example where I'm guessing she'll never be as big as Beyonce and Taylor, to your point, right? But she is a superstar, maybe not at that level, but she is a superstar. My sense is her fans are so incredibly passionate that she may have a very interesting dynamic where she has 60% of the footprint of a Beyonce or a Taylor, but extreme superfan dynamics. Hot take here. She may have more longevity than Taylor. I admire both. I'm a fan of neither in the true sense of what do I actually listen to. But from the outside, it seems like Billie Eilish fans aren't going away.
She definitely tapped into something there. If this was the CD era, someone like a Billie Eilish or Olivia Rodrigo would probably be the biggest artist in the world right now, the same way that someone like a Britney Spears or Justin Timberlake felt that way at particular points. However, Billie Eilish is going on a tour where she's doing 6 straight nights at O2. Justin Timberlake and Britney Spears weren't doing that. So the amount of money that she's able to make and everything else is so much better. So even though she may not be at the same level as those group of artists that blew up before streaming, she's still doing better than any of the people that were those artists back in that era. So I do think that there's a lot that probably shifted in the dynamics there. When the main goal is to sell CDs through Tower Records, and there's limited inventory in Tower Records and limited spots on MTV, that's going to lean itself towards the new artist. But when you're commercializing the industry on something that's an annuity, essentially, with streaming, it flips everything. But it also works in the favor of someone like a Billie Eilish,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's right.
So you've worked at UMG before, but you've said that you learned more about the music industry since leaving the major record label. Why is that?
At UMG, learned a ton, obviously. It was my first gig in the music industry. I was hired at UMG because I had never worked in music before. That was actually a job requirement that the recruiter was looking for. I had a particular narrow focus inside of UMG. It was actually super fans that I was tasked on working on. I didn't have a lot of exposure to what artist deals looked like. I didn't have a lot of exposure to what distribution looked like. I didn't have a lot of exposure to how a producer would fit in or what a broader digital marketing plan and launch would look like. And we're the number one use of our money that artists, whether it's they're taking a $1,500 advance from us or a $4 million advance from us, is to fund the next project. And it's just through osmosis, you start to see how are people using the money and what are the alternatives and all those things. And, you know, you get a different sense from the artist point of view. I was very focused on the fan point of view when I was at UMG. And every artist is an entrepreneur in their own little business. And because we're involved in those funding conversations for artists and independent labels and increasingly producers and now writers, you just see the world from their eyes. And you start to see all the different alternatives, right? At UMG, it was just, we're UMG, the artist is already signed, the deal's already done, now go help them with their superfan strategy. That's all I did. And so you're just forced to see the world more broadly.
There's been a lot of focus on K-pop artists and how they have approached super fandom and storytelling with HYBE and their whole transmedia strategy. a lot of the majors have been trying to adopt and bring a lot of that in for the rest of the artist in-house. Do you think that there are cultural differences in the West that may make that either more difficult or more easy one way or another?
Yeah, I'm not sure. There's no question there's cultural differences. I think that there's probably some common themes, though, where storytelling matters, backstory matters. The whole K-pop industry is arguably not great for the artist, but they also invest a whole lot in the brand of the artist up front, right? And really focus on that. So I think there are things to be learned. How it translates to any particular genre is probably unique to every genre. That's what makes music so hard as well, right? There's no one-size-fits-all strategy for anything, which is, going back to UMG, that's the hardest thing that the labels face, right? Is that you can't be all things to all people. The marketing teams at the labels are fantastic at what they do, but there's no way that they can prioritize every artist on their roster. And there's no way that even for 20% of the artists on those rosters, that however good the marketing team is at the label, that they're the best version of a marketing team for that particular artist at that moment in their career. And that's what makes it hard, is how does the artist find the right team that sort of gets their particular niche, their particular passionate fandom, and unlocks it correctly. That was the whole insight that I had at Universal, was it was just really hard to be all things to all people. And at BeatBread, we don't provide any services at all, not because they're not important, but because they're so important, right? And how do you get the right fit for an artist? Maybe you let them choose the right person and then and the right team, and then switch them along the way, right? That's the theory.
It's a very tough job, because even if you have an artist that may have a team or a label that they want to sign up with, and they may check all those boxes you're talking about, they may still gravitate towards bigger, shinier label that offers bigger advance and household name, and they have this person in the wall. There are all these intangibles. I think it really takes a certain type of artist to be like, you know what? This is what I want. I want to build my own stack. I want to have this company here. I want to have this company here.
Yeah. Yeah. And hopefully we are successful in making the trade-off between the most money and the best services not a trade-off anymore. We're on our way. We started with $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $50,000 advances, and now we're doing multiple seven-figure advances a month. But that's the idea, is to give artists the choice that they don't have to choose between money and team.
Last thing that we should circle up on here, as a venture-backed founder, you have not been shy about voicing your opinion about certain trends that may come through. And it frankly has been a tough time for a lot of companies, especially as things cool down post peak zero interest rates. But how do you navigate all of that? Because I'm sure part of it is a person sharing your thoughts, but you're also a venture-backed founder that has the next round in mind.
Yeah, at risk of getting in trouble here, it's very hard. All VC sectors have an element of what I'm about to describe, but I think music, for some reason, it's like on steroids, where there's this fashionable thing and people lose any sense of perspective or sense. So when we started in 2020, we launched the website. 8 out of 10 venture capitalists we were going to raise money from were lecturing me about why we're so stupid not to be focused on NFTs. And I think this is one of the benefits that I'm not a 22-year-old founder. I think generative AI in general has a ton of legs. I think that all the hype, and obviously this goes beyond music, is real. And I think it will change a lot of workflows in the way that we work. I think it is truly seismic. So that makes sense to me. It doesn't yet totally make sense to me, however, that AI music is going to replace music that people care about. Because I think there's a backstory. This goes back to what I was saying before. Music that has legs, there's something else going on in the brain than just the particular notes and beat on the screen, right? I'm sure generative AI will dominate elevator music and will dominate music for a certain kind of television and movie. Really great syncs, right? Are songs you already know and have a particular meaning, and it resonates right there. Yeah, for some reason, often music will get, I don't know, it's like the last bet in a fund that already looks like it's going to go well from a VC, and music's cool, so they lose their better sense. I don't know. But there's a lot of just head scratchers that I see in music investing. So we've been good so far. Sometimes I'm jealous of people who are able to raise what I think is 10 times too much money. Oh, maybe I wish I wasn't quite so sensible about that.
I do think it leads to stronger companies that are less caught up in that, end off better. It may be a longer road, but this is the same thing we talk about with artists too, right? We've seen so many artists that are the flash in the pans, but who are the artists that really stick around? We've talked about SZA a few times here. This is someone that was ready to quit music 8 years ago. So it wasn't like she just blew up with this album, SOS. Her last album had legs too. And I think if that's true for artists, that's likely true for the startups in the space too. But Peter, this is a lot of fun. I appreciate you coming on.
Yes, thank you.
If you enjoy this episode, please share it with a friend. Send it to one or two people you think would really get value out of listening to this episode. And while you're at it, if you could rate and review the show, that would be great. Rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, rate the podcast on Spotify, rate the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps make sure that the word gets out about Trapital and what we're building here. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next time.